This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll hear from the leader of a Wisconsin effort to boost student voter turnout in this year's midterm elections. Now, a CDC advisory group voted last week to recommend the COVID-19 vaccine be added to the immunization schedules for children and adults. The move does not mean that schools will require the vaccination, though some misinformation to that effect has circulated on social media and elsewhere. Some states and schools do use the vaccine schedules to set their guidelines for students, but those decisions are made at the state or local levels. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the recommended vaccine schedules? Have you run into misinformation, or do you have questions to see if something is true or not? Would you like to see Wisconsin require the COVID-19 vaccine in the future? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Dr. Jonathan Tempty is the Associate Dean for Public Health and Community Engagement at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. He served on the CDC's Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. That's the panel that voted last week to add the COVID-19 vaccine to the immunization schedules. Dr. Tempty, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, thank you very much, Rob. It's always a pleasure to join you.
Can you talk about these vaccine schedules? What are they? How do they work?
Absolutely. The vaccine schedules are created by the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. They're reviewed and endorsed by CDC, but these set the roadmap for the complicated vaccine schedules that we have and provide clinicians like myself, people in pharmacies, and so on, the appropriate information as to what vaccines to give at what age. More importantly, these are not only endorsed by CDC, but there is buy-in by the other groups out there that take care of patients in the country. So for example, the childhood schedule, this is one that goes from birth through age 18, is agreed upon by the American Academy of Pediatrics, the American Academy of Family Physicians, and the CDC. On the other hand, the adult schedule that takes care of everybody else is agreed upon by the family physicians, the American College of Physicians, that's the internal medicine docs, the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology, and the Nurse Midwife Association. So these are not only put together by CDC, but they're also broadly supported by all the immunizing communities out there.
There's been a lot of concern, I think, or confusion maybe about the link between the CDC putting this on the schedule and schools requiring the vaccines that are on that schedule. What are the steps in between those two things?
Well, there are a lot of steps, and it's usually a pretty complicated and complex procedure. The schedules themselves provide us the roadmap of what we should be doing in terms of providing people with the best evidence-based preventive care we can. But it's up to the states to determine whether or not any particular vaccine should be mandated. And let me take a step back that for adults, we really don't have any mandates at all, with the exception for people who are in healthcare settings. Their healthcare system can require immunization, for example, influenza or COVID-19. On the other hand, children, because they are located within areas with high transmissibility, you know, congregated in schools, states have taken on the purview to, from time to time, mandate a vaccine for the safety of the school community.
Here in Wisconsin, can you talk about the process for requiring this particular vaccine, say, and not that other one? For example, I think the CDC guidelines recommend a flu vaccine. Last I checked, I don't think that's required, for example, for schools.
Yeah, I don't know of anywhere in the country that has a requirement for children to get influenza vaccine. But in the state of Wisconsin, it's a straightforward process, but usually takes a long time. It's something that is done on an executive branch level. So, you know, the governor's office and the secretary of the Department of Health Services will formulate the rules. And then it has to go to the legislature for approval. These things usually will take anywhere from 1 to 3 or 4 years to go through. And because it's proposed doesn't mean that it's going to happen. There's a lot of steps in there. So the rules that we do have or the mandates have been well thought out and exist for the benefit of all.
We are talking to Dr. Jonathan Tempty from the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, looking at vaccines for kids and adults, looking at new CDC recommendations for COVID-19 vaccines in particular. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. So Dr. Tempty, let's get into what exactly is the CDC recommending. Let's start with kids. What are they suggesting and when?
This is where it gets really difficult because currently we have for children 3 different vaccines that can be used for COVID-19. We have the Pfizer, BioNTech, the Moderna, and the Novavax vaccines. And when I do teaching on this, I now have a table that has 10 different cells depending on the vaccine and the age range as to what you can do. But in general, what the table or what the recommended vaccine table will provide is the guidance for providing COVID-19 primary vaccine and boosters at the appropriate ages. But again, this really depends on how old you are. And you have to go not off the table, but to the footnotes in the table to get the nuances of exactly when, you know, how many doses, and how long you have to wait to provide a booster dose. So it gets fairly complicated and far more detail than we want to put on the air right now.
Fair enough. Now, for that doctor who's working with parents, say, on a well child visit, does this change much? We already have these vaccines available and some guidelines on how to use them. Does this additional recommendation now from the CDC advisory committee change how a doctor would talk to parents about these vaccines?
I don't think it changes very much in terms of what the doctor or other care provider mentions about vaccines. But I have to say that there's one really profound effect that having this on the tables has. And as we all know, all of us who have received a COVID-19 vaccine so far have gone into University Health Service for me, or to Walgreens for my last booster, or to your clinician office. And none of us have had to pay anything for the vaccines. This is likely to change in the very near future. The federal government will no longer be footing the bill for vaccines. And these can be expensive. I've seen reports of the Pfizer vaccine going to be coming out probably at $130 a dose. So when a vaccine goes onto the table, and there's something else called a vaccine for children resolution. When these things are enacted, all of a sudden it requires the insurance industry to pay for the vaccine. If there is a vaccine that is routinely recommended and on the recommended vaccine schedule, then there's a mandate that the vaccine is paid for. And the reason this is really profound is, number one, not everybody can afford vaccines. We live in a country where there is a great range of incomes. And there will be people who would have to decide whether or not they would pay for a vaccine or to get food, buy gas for the car. So this is really, really important in terms of assurance that everybody has equal access to these vaccines.
Now, how about the CDC recommendations for us grownups? Anything change in these new guidelines from the CDC?
Well, simply by going onto the table, it also requires the vaccine to be covered under the Affordable Care Act on what we call a first dollar coverage. That means you don't have a deductible. It means you don't have any copay. So as long as it's on the recommended vaccine schedule, we also have an ability for this vaccine to be covered.
We're talking to Dr. Jonathan Tempty, Associate Dean of Public Health at the UW School of Medicine, about the COVID-19 vaccine being recommended on the immunization schedules for children and adults. This unanimous vote from an advisory board for the CDC. We're talking about what that does and what it doesn't mean for who gets vaccinated, for requirements at schools, and more. You can join in at 800-642-1234. As we mentioned, this doesn't mean that schools are requiring COVID-19 vaccinations. Would you like them to, or would you like them to stay, in effect, voluntary for kids? Do you have questions about the state of the art of what we know about vaccines, the new booster for particular variants of COVID-19? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now with Dr. Jonathan Tempty, Associate Dean for Public Health and Community Engagement at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, with us today to catch up on the latest COVID-19 vaccine news, including a CDC advisory group recommending the vaccine for the standard immunization schedule. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about what that means? Have you run into claims in the media or social media? You're wondering if they are legit or not. Do you have questions more generally about what we know about vaccines now, what the current recommendations are? 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Sandra is with us in Northern Illinois. Sandra, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to ask about, Sandra?
Just a little bit of confusion. I'm literally scheduled to get my Pfizer booster tomorrow, and I just spoke to a cousin who's scheduled to get the Moderna tomorrow. He said he has read the Moderna booster will cover the variant that is now happening in Europe that is beginning to show up here, but he hasn't heard anything about whether the Pfizer booster will. So I'm confused about which booster I should get.
Sandra, thanks for the call. If Sandra's confused, I imagine other people are too. Dr. Tempty, what do we know about the current boosters and what they're going to cover especially well?
Well, Sandra, the confusion is really widespread just because this has been such a dynamic and rapidly changing world out there. But both of the boosters that are approved now by FDA and are recommended by CDC are what we call bivalent boosters. They contain elements of the very original strain and elements of the BA4, BA5. So these should be reasonable vaccines to get at this time. The BA4, BA5 are both Omicron variants. And because of that, we get a broader immune response than from the original vaccine. So you should be fine with either Moderna or Pfizer.
Sandra, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Dr. Tempty, for that person who has had, you know, the original round and maybe the first boosters out there, can you talk a little bit about this new variant booster and the difference it can make given, as you said, this changing viral landscape?
Well, it's very interesting because as we have seen this virus evolve and change, we're not only seeing a different realm or a different spectrum of symptoms, but we're also seeing different spectrum in terms of, you know, things like case fatality rates, how many people are dying of this, what's the likelihood of hospitalization. But I think as time goes on, the vaccines have to adapt to what the variants we are encountering are at this point in time. And so with the mRNA technology, this allows a pretty rapid response, but it requires ongoing surveillance, not only here in Wisconsin, United States, but across the world, not only to see what we have, but to see what's emerging. And this will be a changing environment, I would say, you know, at least for the coming months to coming years. And the vaccine we have for a booster a year from now is probably going to be different from what we have now, but we just don't quite know where we're going to be.
Thanks again for that call, Sandra, at 800-642-1234. Dr. Tempty, I think in a lot of people's minds, COVID is on the back burner in some ways, and in part because there's some good news. The rates of people getting it are down. The death rate is down, but it's not gone. When you look at the charts, you know, we've been hovering at about 400 plus or minus deaths per day in the United States. That is definitely not nothing. How much concern do you have right now?
Well, in each of those 400 deaths per day represent, you know, multiply by 4 or 5 or 10 the number of people who are being really closely and personally affected. And then you have to think in terms of the resources behind for every death. There are numerous people who are hospitalized that are in ICU. You have all the caregivers, all the people who are, you know, putting in extra hours to care for these people in hospital, in nursing homes, and so on. So the toll is just immense, both in terms of the economic cost, but in the sure human cost. So yes, this is far from over, and this is still continuing to be much more intense than your typical influenza outbreak. I think if you've been following the news over the last couple of weeks, we are also seeing influenza starting to come back, particularly in the southern states, and it will move up to Wisconsin. We're also seeing a lot of respiratory syncytial virus. This is one that really plays havoc with young children and older people. And we're seeing both influenza and RSV coming aboard much earlier than we typically do in a typical year. So I think the concern is if we're already having hospitals somewhat occupied by COVID, and then you start throwing on top these other respiratory infections, we could be dealing with a lot of just congestion in the hospitals, a lot of services that we just can't provide. So I think we have to be very, very careful. And that's my plug right now to remind people to get their influenza vaccine if you haven't get it as soon as possible.
Let's bring on another caller at 800-642-1234. Lenny is with us in Lake Geneva. Lenny, hi.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
What did you want to ask about, Lenny?
You know, I was vaccinated originally over a year ago, a couple of times. I haven't had any boosters. I'm 60 years old. I'm really healthy. However, I found out that I have atrial fibrillation, which is a heart condition. Been ablated twice. I'm in good shape now. But some of these vaccines, it seems as though there's been some heart issues that have dropped out of them. And I'm wondering if this vaccine is safe.
Lenny, talk about that. Thanks, Dr. Tempty.
Yeah, that's an excellent question. What we have found is at a low level, the mRNA vaccines, so the Moderna and the Pfizer, can be associated with what we call myocarditis or pericarditis. This is inflammation of the heart tissue. The good news in two ways is, number one, it's very rare. Number two, it's largely hit young males, so adolescent and males in their 20s. By the time you get into your 50s and 60s, this phenomenon pretty much has disappeared. It also has not really appeared in individuals younger than about 12 years old. So for your case, I wouldn't be particularly concerned in terms of the atrial fibrillation and issues along that line.
Thanks a lot for that call, Lenny. And Dr. Tempty, that myocarditis risk you mentioned, especially for younger men, we also must have to, I think, compare that to the risk of myocarditis that you get from having COVID itself, right?
Absolutely. And again, one has to be careful because the information is constantly changing. And what we know from the original strain, the pre-Delta, the Delta, the Omicron, the information keeps on changing, and researchers, people who are out there doing epidemiology, are constantly trying to keep up with this. But the bottom line is that the myocarditis we're seeing, you know, per immunization provided, is far less of a risk than the myocarditis per case of COVID acquired by an individual. So I think in terms of the risk benefit, the vaccines truly are very, very beneficial.
I wanted to ask, you mentioned the risk of flu and the need for flu vaccine. I think a common question people have is, can I get the flu vaccine as at the same time as a COVID initial vaccine or booster? I assume that's okay because I call it flustered. I got my flu vaccine and the Omicron booster at the same time. That's cool, right?
Yeah, that should be fine. Actually, this has been studied in the past. And we find that when both influenza vaccine and the COVID vaccine are provided together, both are immunogenic, meaning you get immunity from both of them, and it doesn't increase the level of side effects that you get above either of the vaccines.
And you mentioned earlier I think it was the Novavax vaccine. If I have this right, that's not an mRNA one like Pfizer or Moderna is. Is there a case where I'd want to say I want the mRNA versus the other kind?
Well, I think at this point in time, the Novavax, you know, provides an opportunity for people who wish to avoid the mRNA. The current Novavax vaccine is built off the original virus. And so we don't have yet a booster for the Novavax. However, CDC says that if you have received your initial two doses of Novavax, you can get a booster with the Pfizer vaccine following that.
Dr. Tepti, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us again today.
Well, thank you so much for having me, and hopefully everybody remembers to get their flu vaccine as well.
That's Dr. Jonathan Tempty, Associate Dean for Public Health and Community Engagement at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. He is with us today to check in on the latest COVID-19 vaccine news, with the CDC advisory group recommending it be added to immunization schedules for children and for adults. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, it's Mushrooms and Beyond. Explore the strange science of fungus life forms with the author of the book, The Hidden Kingdom of Fungi. And if you have questions about mushrooms and other fungus, this is your chance. Email ideas@WPR.org. And then join the conversation tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Okay, a few moments ago, I said a word that always makes me think twice about how you pronounce it. It's the word for more than one fungus, F-U-N-G-I. I always got to think, do I pronounce it fungi or fungi? As I often do, I looked it up in an online dictionary and found that the correct answer to the question of fungi or fungi is yes. Turns out they're both acceptable pronunciations. That's good news and bad news. Good news, I get it right either way. Bad news, a lot of people will think I got it wrong either way. An occupational hazard. Here's one that came up, though, long before I was on the radio. A friend of mine used to say the word theater as theater, and there was a good-natured dispute about that. We looked it up in the dictionary, a book kind. We didn't have the internet dictionaries at that point. The answer is theater is an acceptable alternative pronunciation, more common in the southern United States. He's from Marinette, though, pretty far from the southern U.S. If you have a unique pronunciation that you stick with, let us know. Email ideas@WPR.org. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Neanderthal DNA can help us better understand our own health. A paleoanthropologist joins us to talk about the latest research. Now, colleges around Wisconsin are trying to figure out how to get more students. National student turnout has surged over the last couple elections. It's not clear if that trend will continue, and advocates say barriers in states like Wisconsin can make it harder for students to cast their ballots. Our next guest is part of an effort to address some of the barriers colleges have control over, including being too busy to vote. He's part of a coalition of private colleges and universities across the state that are canceling classes on Election Day in an effort to make it easier for students to vote. Ron Watson is an associate professor of political science and health and society at Beloit College, one of the people behind the campaign, Why Bother Wisconsin? Ron, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Can you tell us why Beloit College is joining other private institutions around the state in canceling classes on Election Day?
Well, our hope, of course, is that we can move to help students make voting a lifelong habit. And I think that all of us recognize today, especially those in higher education, that American democracy is facing some of its greatest challenges, certainly that I've seen in my lifetime, and I think most people have seen in theirs. And so in that sense, we really are hoping that young people will tune into to voting and make it something that they do from here on out.
Can you talk about some of the barriers that students might face when they're trying to cast their ballots?
Absolutely. Well, one of the things that I think a number of students have to deal with is their IDs. For some schools, they are required to have a specific voter ID. And some of the schools in Wisconsin are able to produce that. We're fortunate at Beloit that our student ID does seem to be in compliance with the law in terms of what's necessary. But again, many students across the state maybe face this as a barrier. Some of the other things are even things like work. Any number of students have to work, and they have to work to put themselves through school. And so in that sense, anything that we can do, including moving our schedules around so that we can either reduce or cancel classes on Election Day, will help to get them to the polls.
And the issue of classes on Election Day is just one part of the campaign. You're also reaching out to students. The name itself, Why Bother Wisconsin, suggests that you're hoping to overcome any apathy or reluctance to vote. Can you talk about that side of the campaign?
Well, absolutely. So we've been trying to run a number of different events to raise awareness about voting on campus. But we know that students often, especially when we're young, we often have the sense that voting doesn't matter. And in fact, we've had some conversations with a couple of students here fairly recently, in which they've expressed sort of their concern about the idea of voting itself, including that they just don't feel that any of the candidates represent them, or that they are worried that if they vote for one particular candidate, that they'll have sort of buyer's remorse around it. And what we're hoping is through some of these events is just to get people talking about this, because this is an understandable concern. But we hope that students will come away understanding that the most important thing is to contribute to the functioning of our democracy, because the alternative is certainly something that they would not want to experience.
And you're also thinking, I think, about wider issues of civic engagement. Can you talk about what you might be talking about with students beyond casting the ballot itself?
Well, this is one of the pieces here, right, is I think that to make civic engagement a lifelong activity, right? Voting, of course, is simply part of that. But we want students to get out and to get their not only get out to vote themselves, but to encourage their family members, to encourage other students to vote, but also to be active in speaking with and communicating with their elected officials and those who are running for office. I mean, in fact, we are holding a candidate forum here on Thursday on campus, where we're hoping that students will come out and really ask some tough questions of the candidates.
Beloit College is in this. I think 8 private colleges and universities around the state are involved. What would you say to your colleagues at other institutions that haven't gotten on board to encourage them to do something like this Why Bother Wisconsin campaign?
Well, I think the one thing that I would say is that ultimately we all want to live in a country that has a democracy and that values democratic governance. And to the extent that civics education has really taken a beating at the secondary level, we're hoping that colleges and universities will step up, recognize that we are sort of one of the last areas where young people can really become educated in how to be citizens and what it means to be a citizen in a democracy. And I think even if they aren't able to create a day off, because we know in higher education how precious that time is, even if they can't do that, there are a variety of other events and other ways to incentivize students to be involved in the political process. And I hope our other institutions across the state will take that to heart.
And that's higher education. Would you hope that, employers and others would also do something similar to help people participate on Election Day?
Oh my goodness, that would be the absolute ideal, isn't it? Wouldn't it be, right? Because I think we have to all recognize that taking part in this democracy is everyone's responsibility, right? It's not just the responsibility of elementary schools or high schools or colleges and universities, but every person in our society who values what it means to live under a democratic government has to take it as a responsibility. I mean, I have to tell you, over the years, I have heard any number of folks say, for example, they couldn't go to work. And I'm not talking about just students, but they had to go to work to vote or instead of voting, or they couldn't go to work because they had to vote. And there shouldn't be that sort of conflict. Taking part in our governance is critical to who we are as people. And you know, it seems to me that it makes sense for even companies to join in on this kind of movement.
And obviously, I imagine you've got your eyes on the midterm elections next month for the project. What's next after that?
Well, we hope to keep the momentum going into April, right? Because we know there's some important state Supreme Court related elections happening then. So, and then of course, having our eyes ever forward to the 2024 election. It's important for us to, again, build up the momentum and find the best practices that will get students out and engaged in our political process.
Ron, thanks again for joining us today.
Not at all. Thank you.
That's Ron Watson, Associate Professor of Political Science at Beloit College, with us today to talk about an effort to make voting easier for college students. This is a partnership of private colleges and universities around the state. It's called Why Bother Wisconsin. It includes canceling or limiting classes on Election Day, among other things. You can find more info about it at WPR.org/Central Time. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Carl Christensen with a story about a parent's business.
Running a family business can instill pride and a valuable work ethic that circulates through the household. Wisconsin writer Nancy Jorgensen shares a story about growing up around her father's printing business and its lasting impact on future generations of the family.
My dad's work shirts, button down, short sleeved, white or blue, smelled like ink. The scent radiated, faint each morning when he wore a clean one, heavy in the evenings after a day in the shop. When ink dries, it releases the scent of aldehydes, ketones, and carboxylic acids. To me, it was the aroma of security, pride, and hard work. My dad birthed his offset printing company the same year I was born, in 1954, when paper companies and print shops flourished in Wisconsin. During the day, he ran jobs in another printer's shop, and in the evenings, he operated his own press. He worked from our basement, where paper and color became brochures, pamphlets, and books. While my mother fed and tended to me, he nurtured his other baby. Like twins, the business and I grew together. Within a few years, my dad quit his day job and bought more presses, cameras, a cutter, folder, stitcher, and drill. He mortgaged a building and created a press room, darkroom, bindery, and office. He stocked paper, glue, and ink. An entrepreneur, he grew a business alongside his family, and soon I had a brother and sister. The business sent my siblings and me to college, and in the summer between semesters, I worked in the bindery. My fingers studied the sensations of gloss, matte, and silk. My arms weighed the difference between a newspaper and the sheets of a magazine. As ideas and information became leaflets and publications, I inhaled the chemicals straight from their ink-soaked pages. My dad chose a business for the future, a legacy for our family, a product that would always be in demand. Didn't every college need a course brochure? Didn't every auction need a catalog? Didn't every city need a wall calendar? He paid a fair wage to salesmen, pressmen, cameramen, and secretaries, and he carved room in the budget for donations to local schools, to the Park and Recreation Department, to the Schoenstatt sisters, in their long black habits, who needed materials for their retreats. My dad died before the collapse of Wisconsin's printing industry. Confident, he left my brother a profitable legacy. But when colleges and auctions and city governments moved information online and print shops around the state folded, my brother said, "Dad would want me to face reality and make tough choices." My grandson Stanley, 2.5 years of age, learns songs from YouTube. He pinches a screen to watch a favorite show. He shouts at the alarm on my phone, "Hey Google, stop." He is a child of Wi-Fi, of FaceTime, of Instagram, of Twitter, and his parents buy more broadband than number 2 pencils, more 4G than spiral notebooks. But when Stanley is tired, he offers me his favorite book. "Grandma, read." He strokes the fur on a page about animals. He screams siren sounds at a page about fire trucks. He sniffs the image of a rose on a page about flowers. When Stanley is older, I will show him my drawer full of his great-grandpa's work. Covers and insides, shiny and black, or clean and white, or textured and variegated. Relics of a not-so-long-ago time and a man who made an imprint.
That was writer and Waukesha native Nancy Jorgensen. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast feed wherever you get your podcasts. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Carl Christensen.
Coming up, new research tells us how the Neanderthal genome can tell us about our own health. A Wisconsin researcher takes us on a journey tens of thousands of years in the making. That's next here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Swedish scientist Svante Paabo was awarded the Nobel Prize in Medicine for his work deciphering the Neanderthal genome. His research provided new information about Neanderthal culture and society and info that can teach us, humans living thousands of years after Neanderthals, about our own health. John Hawks is a paleoanthropologist and distinguished achievement professor in anthropology at UW-Madison. John, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
First, can you situate Neanderthals in our family tree, which changes over time, sometimes with new information? How are they related to us?
Sure. Neanderthals are a group of people who lived between about 450,000 years ago and about 40,000 years ago in the western half of Eurasia, broadly put. And they are the most numerous fossil representative of the human lineage. They are the most recent extinct members of our lineage, and they're ones that we know the most about.
Now, a lot of our conversation today is about their DNA. And you just said 40,000 years ago. How hard is it to get useful DNA profiles of someone that lived 40,000 years ago?
You know, it's really remarkable. When I was a student in the 1990s, I used to tell people, this is never going to be possible. And, you know, Jurassic Park was a thing. So people were curious, you know, is it possible to get genetic information from the past? There were many, many barriers to it. DNA breaks down over time. And it's a chemical. It's a tough chemical. It can last in your body and after you die for some period of time. But it inevitably breaks down into really, really tiny fragments. It was the technical advances of, you know, really the years from 2000 to 2010 in which our methods of sequencing genetics began to rely on an approach that was breaking down people's DNA into tiny fragments and sequencing them all, that shotgun sequencing approach that made people able to take tiny fragments of DNA from ancient sites and do anything with them at all. Today, it is, you know, I wouldn't say routine, but with very specialized laboratories and approaches, it's possible to get genetic evidence out of 40,000, 100,000-year-old fossils that are as good a quality as we can get from living people.
And then did I see this study that just came out? Was this over the weekend? We have what might be a whole family or at least a closely connected community of Neanderthals. We've got their DNA now.
This is really a fascinating story for me. This is a cave in southern Russia, in Siberia, where there are tiny bone fragments from an archaeological layer that dates to somewhere around 45,000 to 60,000 years ago. And those tiny bone fragments now, every single one of them has had DNA application to it. And they were able to uncover that some of them were tiny fragments of a single individual. There was a pair of a tiny piece of vertebra and a tooth that were the father and his daughter. There were others that were aunt and nephew or second order relatives of that kind. So that picture of a Neanderthal group made up of, I think, 15 individuals, where you can see the kinship among them, gives us a picture of a past society that would have been totally impossible to imagine 10, 15 years ago.
Talking to John Hawks, paleoanthropologist at UW-Madison, talking about Neanderthal DNA, how we're extracting it, using it, finding stuff out about it, and what it means for our health today. And let's get into that. This is cool in and of itself, but also we can learn lessons about our DNA and its relation to our health now?
Yeah, that's exactly right. One of the really, you know, just profound things that was learned from getting the genomes of these ancient people is that there are very, very few things that make us different from them. You know, we have their DNA today in a small fraction. You know, you and I are something like 2%. We can trace our ancestry to this ancient group. They're not really extinct in that sense, right? We are their descendants. The genes that we got from them are still in our genomes doing stuff. And it's possible to study today tens of thousands of people and look at them and see, okay, the people that carry this Neanderthal gene here, how are they different from the ones who don't have that? There are several genes that impact human immunity and human responses to viruses that, for example, that are from Neanderthals. With COVID-19, Svante's group, the Nobel Prize winner, found that there is a genetic variant that's relatively common in Northern Europe that increases susceptibility to severe COVID, right? People who get that severe COVID hospitalization, they're more likely to carry this variant. With other things, we think that the Neanderthal variation may actually improve matters, may give us resistance to things that today, you know, are a problem for people. So, there's no predicting, right? It's not like all the Neanderthal stuff is good or all the Neanderthal stuff is bad. But understanding the evolutionary history of these particular gene variants gives us a way of looking at the variations today and understanding why they're different and where they came from.
Now, I saw recently a more recent example during the Great Black Death of the 1300s.
Yeah.
Some people had a better chance of surviving if they had a gene that apparently may contribute to Crohn's disease today. Mm-hmm. Good then, bad now. Are we going to be finding more examples of that, maybe from the Neanderthal era, and maybe even reverse engineering it and figuring out these are the diseases that afflicted them back then?
You know, some of the major health challenges today, like Crohn's disease, are autoimmune diseases. And we know that the immune system is an adaptive system within our bodies that's responding to the environments we're exposed to. Today's environments are different from the environments of past people in lots of ways. And one of the biggest ways is that with sanitation, with improved cleanliness, right, the way that we have modern life, it's removing many things that past peoples would have been exposed to early in their lives, you know, worms and parasites and bacteria, right, that were once ubiquitous in environments. Today, we're not exposed to as much. There's a major line of thought about autoimmune disease is that actually this is on the increase because we are changing environments in this way. And so understanding how these genes were active in past environments and the things that they actually helped to adapt people to survive, that can give us some clues about the biological mechanisms that we might be able to tweak today to make a difference to some of these conditions.
Now, Neanderthals are one of our relatives. They're not the only relative of ours from the past. Is there hope that we'll be getting usable DNA from other parts of, I don't know if the family tree is the right word anymore, but of our heritage there?
That's exactly right. You know, we today are able to get DNA most easily out of sites that have a relatively cold annual temperature. And that's why there's a real bias in our recovery of DNA from Europe, from parts of Asia that are sort of not tropical Asia, northern Asia. And where I work in southern Africa, it is right now not possible to get DNA from these ancient time periods. And it's because of the temperature and because of the preservation environment. There is hope that new technologies will give us access to even tinier fragments of DNA, or that we'll find situations in which it happens to be preserved more. But another way of looking at the past is by sampling ancient proteins. And we're very interested in that in my team working in southern Africa now. We're finding protein that is preserved in teeth that can be millions of years old. And that's going to give us some information. It's not as much as having a genome that has 6 billion base pairs of information. You know, proteins are relatively small compared to that, but it still may tell us some interesting clues about how these different species are connected to each other.
Could that kind of thing give us a sense of what people, say, ate or the kind of diseases they got, those proteins?
Yeah. So with the teeth, one of the biggest clues that we get from it is the things that actually affect teeth. Mm-hmm. And one of the most promising avenues of information today about past peoples is actually sampling the outsides of their teeth. The calculus that forms on your teeth, right? If you go to the dentist and get this scraped off, right, it's tartar, and we do tartar control to try to take it off, right? For paleontologists, that is the most amazing thing, because because it actually, I mean, it's kind of gross, but it's preserving tiny pieces of plants, it's preserving bacteria, and it's preserving the DNA of the individuals and also their microbiome. And we are getting more and more information out of that source.
John, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's John Hawks, paleoanthropologist and distinguished achievement professor in anthropology at UW-Madison. He joined us today to look at Neanderthal DNA, which we can find and test and analyze, and why it matters for our health today, 2022. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, trace the journey of African cooking to the United States with the author of the book High on the Hog, A Culinary Journey from Africa to America. That author giving a talk, by the way, coming up at UW Stevens Point. And WPR music host Sheila Shigley from Simply Folk joins the show with some great seasonal and holiday music recommendations. She's going to have some samples for us to share. Maybe you can call in with your own suggestions. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.